The first day of summer is fast approaching on Friday, June 21st, and that means a lot of time spent outdoors, enjoying hiking, biking, boating, and of course cooking out. It also means having to deal with insects while you're trying to have a good time. I'm Robin Cherry, filling in for Larry Mueller. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri joins us today. He is the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he gives about 40 to 50 talks a year and conducts workshops around the state. Welcome to the show, Phil.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Well, it feels like summer is finally here. And after the long winter, we love the warm weather, but not the mosquitoes that come with it. What are we in for this summer?
Well, first of all, it's not my fault. It's the weatherman.
Okay.
You know, last year was in a good part of the state excessively dry, and mosquitoes basically need water to breed. And so people kind of forget what normal mosquitoes are like. And the dynamic of this year is, in many cases, we're 7 to 10 inches above the norm in rainfall. There's a lot of standing water, and that means a lot of mosquitoes. And a little bit slow in happening, basically because everything was slow this year. But in most places for the last 2 or 3 weeks, if you go looking for them, you have no trouble finding them. And you know, unfortunately, that's part of the norm for this state, especially at dusk and dawn when they're most active.
Yeah. So is there anything we can do to minimize the mosquito population, especially around our home?
Well, what makes it tough is the biggest problem, mosquitoes breed up to 15, 20 miles away, and they kind of blow in as adults. So it's not as if they're breeding on your property. But the reality is during the day when the winds are up, the light is up, mosquitoes don't want to fly. So they tend to congregate where it's cool, damp, and dark. So that's lush vegetation. So keeping the grass mowed, keeping airflow going, keeping things dry, all tends to give them less places to hide. And that means at least for the short run, less mosquitoes. But the problem at night when they become quite active and the wind speeds go down, then they kind of disperse. But as I said, keeping things mowed, keeping things pruned, definitely helps. I mean, you can see this. I always tease golfers, but if you know, you're a good golfer, you stay in the fairway, there's no mosquitoes, you hit back in the rough and you start walking that long grass, it's like clouds coming up. And that gives you an idea of what they're doing. They're just hiding and waiting until the conditions are right for them to come out.
So when we are preparing to spend time outdoors, we're told cover up, to wear, you know, thick fabrics, long sleeves, and pants to have less skin exposed to the sun. Can mosquitoes bite us through our clothes?
Real thin cotton, yes.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it gets, you know, I use that suggestion more for tick control because ticks, you know, are looking for skin. For mosquitoes, to be honest, the thing I've talked about before on the show, that's, you know, if you're an outdoor person, a gardener, and spends a lot of time, you know, and just putting that much clothing on is not comfortable. The one thing to consider is that it's been, some of the sporting goods stores, they do sell mosquito suits. They're just kind of a net mesh, real billowy. You still get enough airflow that you can stay pretty comfortable, but yet they even have a little hood. So if the mosquitoes are just atrocious, you pull the hood over the top and protect your face and can enjoy the outdoors. So as I said, that's something I would consider. I have one in the back of my car at all times, just in case I get in an area. As I said, I slip it on and I can still have a t-shirt on, but yet stay comfortable.
Now, we're often told to buy products like Off and DEET, and that should help keep the mosquitoes away. What do you think about that?
Well, definitely, you know, DEET is an interesting product. It has been basically the product of choice for about 6-7 decades now. And it works in a manner that it confuses the mosquito. If you ever watch, what happens is they come flying into about 2 or 3 inches away from you, and they kind of stop like they hit a wall. And the reason for that is it blocks the lactic acid receptors on their antennae, and that's what the mosquito is looking for to tell the difference between you and a tree if you're secreting lactic acid. Now, of interest is that there's some alternative products that have come on board. There's soybean oils, eucalyptus oils, citronella oils, even a European product called Picardin that has activity. These are also products that work. The difference between the various products have to do with concentrations and how they're formulated. So the products that stop working in 20 minutes versus other ones can last for 4 or 5 hours. So it's kind of a decision on what people want. The concern with DEET, I guess, because you do absorb a certain percentage of that product, is it's best probably to stay away from the real concentrated forms. If you've ever worked with the concentrated forms, you'll find they even melt plastic, you know, so you got to be careful with watch crystals and other things when you're handling it. And in most cases, you don't need anything that concentrated unless you're, you know, going off into a swamp for 6 hours or something and the like. So as I said, DEET has a good track record, but there are definitely alternatives for people that would look for things. And as I said, the soybean oils, the eucalyptus oils are products that come to mind.
Are mosquitoes attracted to fragrance, perfumes, aftershave, that kind of thing?
To a little degree, but the biggest compound that draws them in is carbon dioxide that we give off when we breathe. Lactic acid is the second most important. Then it becomes acetone, which is a product that is secreted by the skin. And then there's this whole organic soup. They literally down in Florida at Gainesville have put people into chambers. They basically take all the gases off the people and then analyze them and then test how the mosquitoes respond. So they have this concoction. But one of the things the researchers will tell you is although they have this organic soup that attracts mosquitoes, you can still find individuals in the population that will far out-tract the mosquito compared to that. Now, where the thought about fragrances come is it turns out that sometimes mosquitoes will go to flowers to get a sugar source for energy. And, of course, flowers have fragrances. So there's a little truth to it, but definitely the carbon dioxide and lactic acid are far more important than the fragrances.
Okay. Well, let's go to the phones. Let's switch gears a moment. We have Rochelle from Mount Horeb. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about carpenter ants. I have a nest of carpenter ants on my back porch, kind of between the lower porch and the upper porch, kind of in the ceiling of the porch, and also out in the tree. I followed your advice. I followed the ants. I've seen them walk across the wires to the house. My questions are, when is the best time of year to tear into a nest, and how would I prevent the spread of the ants to other places, including further inside the house? My worst fear is that when I tear apart the nest, I know this is the time of year that they swarm, and so I don't want them to swarm all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I want to know is there a list that you maintain of recommended professionals that would help take care of the ants? I know they're also in a nest out in the tree, higher than what I can reach, so I'm going to have to hire someone to come out and either put some dust or something there. I don't want to poison the wildlife. I don't want to poison the kids that are playing across the fence. So is there a list of recommended people that have these things to spray or take care of a carpenter's ant's nest?
Okay. So the first thing, the swarming phenomena is how they go and make new nests. Now, what's unique about carpenter ants, or not unique, but is important to know is there's only a single queen that's the mother of everything. And so that's why we so often talk about finding the nest and killing the queen for control. Now, the wing forms that you see that come out that we call the swarmers are virgin queens. And to be honest, this is the time of the year we tend to see carpenter ants swarming. Anybody that's got trees on their property probably has carpenter ants. And so I don't worry so much about it spreading like a fire where we're going to get all these multiple new nests when we disturb a nest. To be honest, the success rate is probably about 4 or 5% from the queens, and they're looking for rotting wood. So if you don't have the right environment, they will not be there. The other side, if you've got a bad spot in your roof, eventually I expect them to find it. So now, opening up the nest, it isn't really important you open up the nest. What's important is if you know where the nest is treat it. And it's not as if the pest control services have products different than what you can get at the store. The active ingredients are pretty much the same. At times, they have a couple formulations that might be different. So it's all about experience. I think the thing you're gaining from a pest control service is that they've dealt with this before. They do have some commercial baits they can use, which is an alternative method of trying to kill carpenter ants, but still the more direct method is to find the nest and treat it. They're restricted in what they can use by EPA. So as I said, the interesting thing is it's not as if it's any different than you going to the hardware store, buying something and spraying it as far as the toxicity concerns. In particular, if you're using this correctly, you're spraying in places where the kids aren't going to be. You don't spray the trunk of the tree. You spray into the hole in the tree where you think you find the nest. Now, as far as getting service, I always tell people to talk to two or three companies. In our state, somebody needs to be certified by the state in order to apply pesticides commercially. That means at least they have a minimum competency on safety. The reason I suggest to talk to two or three companies is you get opinions. My personal opinion on carpenter ants is you treat it once and put the fire out. I really don't think there's a need to come back once a month, because if you don't do it right the first time, why do you need to come back, type of thing. We don't really officially have an approved list. As I said, the people are certified by the state. You can ask for their certification, so that shows at least that the state's aware that they're in the business. And as I said, if you talk to two or three companies, and especially if you give yourself a little bit of an education on carpenter ant biology and then see the stories they tell you back, and if it matches, you know that they're being upfront with you. If they start telling you fishy things about dormant eggs that are going to last for 2 years and then hatch, that's not a biological truth, and then you know that they're being misleading. But I will tell you, in my career, I have found that the companies have gotten far more professional, and I really just don't hear those silly stories anymore like I used to when I first started.
Is the word carpenter an accurate name for these ants? Are they a danger to wood?
Well, I think that we made a mistake here. Now, there is a species out in the West Coast that is very aggressive in sound wood. But what you find here is they don't eat wood for a living. And that's the deceptive part. But what they love to do is get in wood that is softened and compromised. So somebody has a leak problem in the roof, the wood starts to go bad, the ants move into it. And you can see why, when you see the leak, you open up the roof, you find the ants, you say, those damn ants ruined my roof. The water ruined your roof. And so, to me, it is really quite deceiving. Now, termites, on the other hand, eat cellulose as the main diet. So your whole house is a restaurant for termites. Whereas, as I said, the story about carpenter ants is that typically they're looking for the equivalent of a rotting stump, which is weak and softened wood. But I've seen them in styrofoam. I've seen them in hollow spaces and doors. I mean, they do utilize other environments at times. And the trick is to try to hunt them down. And the more patient you are, the more observant you are, the more likely you've got success.
All right. If you're just now tuning in, I'm Robin Sherry, filling in for Larry Mueller. And my guest today is Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist with the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And we are taking your questions today. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones. Don from Warren, Illinois. Good afternoon.
Excuse me. I have not seen a monarch butterfly yet. Second, I've never ceased to be baffled by the nature and the tricks it pulls. My son took me outside in the evening and put a headlight on me. Now, for you people who have never hunted raccoon, what you do is you put a headlight just above your eyes and face it in the direction you're looking. So when you look, the headlight follows you. And nocturnal animals, their eyes are such that they reflect light. So you shine that on these nocturnal animals, and the light comes back like a headlight. Deer in the headlights kind of thing. So he took me out, and he put the headlight on, and we went to a brushy area. And he said, now get the right distance, and the light's not too bright. And here we see these tiny, brilliant, green lights. And I said, what the heck are those? And he said, wolf spiders. Their eyes are shining back at you. And we walked around, and in the right places, they're all over the place. It just blew my mind. It was so wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the monarch thing, it has not been a good year, and it has to do with the weather patterns. And I have not seen one. I was giving a talk in Racine a couple weeks ago, and somebody there had observed one. Because they're really kind of blowing in, it depends on the weather patterns. And we haven't had that much in the way of strong southerly air flows. Most of our winds have been coming from the north and the like. And so they're late to get here. But everything is late this year. And, of course, last year was so 180 degrees different. We had monarchs up here in April. And so I still think we've got a chance. Our butterfly weed is just up enough now that it would make a good food plant for them. So stay patient. Now, the wolf spiders, a nighttime hunting spider, some of them get quite large and scary looking, but they're pretty much harmless. But as you say, their eyes are basically designed for nighttime hunting. And if you get light in them, they are just amazing. I mean, it's like a piece of jewelry. And they have 8 eyes, believe it or not. Now, a couple of them are a little bit bigger than the others. And so those are probably the ones you saw reflect. And, people often don't understand how many creatures are really out there. And because these things are only seen at night, as I said, you often maybe not believe that there could be that many spiders out there. But thank goodness there are, because, of course, they're eating insects for a living, which is meaning that we'll probably have less pests.
All right. Thanks for your call, Don. I'm Robin Cherry, filling in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Robin Cherry, filling in for Larry Mueller. And joining me today is UW-Madison entomologist Phil Pelletieri. And we're talking insects. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And if you have a picture you'd like Phil to ID, post a picture on our Facebook and he'll take a look at it. Or you can email us. Send us an email at talk@wpr.org. And we're going to get right back to the phones. Daniel, good morning.
Hello. I picked a deer tick off this morning. The first time I saw one was in 1981. I pulled a very small, previously unseen to me anyway, tick off my shoulder and suffered the symptoms of Lyme's disease in 1981. When was the deer tick carrier of Lyme's disease first found or reported in Wisconsin?
The first records are 1969, and the reason I know that, it was a graduate student in our department that was doing a study of the parasites of mice. He found the tick and he published a paper on it because the Ixodes tick that he found had not been found north of parts of Texas and the like, and so it was quite a find. Now, this is before Lyme disease was officially discovered, and so that's our first record. It was up in the northwest part of the state, up around the Spooner area, and then over time we saw the distribution of that tick spread. Now, the question often comes up, where did it come from? And the interesting thing is we know for a fact during the Ice Age that both the deer and the ticks got totally wiped out. So they had to get brought back in here, most likely on migrating birds. But to get a male and female tick, both adults, in the same spot. And then the other very critical factor to keep deer ticks happy are deer. You need a certain deer density. And so my guess is there were probably very low populations here, even maybe a century before that, but just not to the point of being able to breed and being easy to find. And then the other part of the story is that Lyme disease is a mouse disease that the tick acquires and then spreads. And so there's a number of things you have to fall into place to get it. But definitely from that original find, the first discovery of Lyme disease and the description back in the 80s, and now, you know, we're up over 3,500 cases for 2011. And this has been a trend we've seen throughout the United States, both in the East Coast and here, is that ticks keep spreading in areas and the percentage of people that are getting Lyme disease keeps increasing.
Phil in Hebron, Illinois, has a question about dog ticks. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm standing on the edge of a cornfield, and I came up with a second question. My question is removal of dog ticks on human beings. Mm-hmm. Best way, good trick. And the other question is, this is about a 3,000-acre field of BT corn I'm standing next to. They applied their Roundup 12, 15 days ago and killed the weeds. They're presently applying insecticide. Do you have any idea what they're doing? I haven't been able to flag the sprayer down yet.
Wow. I a little surprised, because I'll tell you, BT corn usually takes care of any kind of problem you normally expect, and I have not heard of any kind of insect outbreaks in corn. It's been kind of quiet agriculturally. So it would be worth asking, because I don't have a clue at this time of the year. The thing you've got to understand about ticks is their mouth is really quite different than you might expect. Think of your thumb. It is a thumb-like structure, and it has little barbs on it that point backwards. Now, depending on the kind of tick, some of the ticks even glue this thing in aside from just having the barbs. And so when people put things on ticks and think that they will unattach immediately, it can't happen that way. It's a much more complicated and slower process. So usually what you talk about is grabbing as close to the base of what you'd call the head. It's not a head like we have, but this mouth structure, and pull slow and steady. If you break it off, it's the equivalent of having a sliver in you. So there's concern about secondary infections, but not more than that. You know, for dogs, they sell this little tick key, and it's a little plastic device that you put around the tick and you pull it, and it basically grasps it so close to the skin, and then you pull slow and steady. So for people who get exposed to a lot of ticks, that's a way to go. Research at Ohio State has shown us that putting olive oil on and burning them and all these other things, it really doesn't help. And in some cases, when you're using fire, it has a chance of damaging the tissue there. So as I said, grab it as close as you can, and slow and steady is the way to remove any tick.
Can I throw one more quick one at you? While I was on hold, I went on the computer. The University of Illinois is reporting in Illinois and Iowa, they're seeing resistance of corn borer rootworm to BT corn. In other words, it ain't working anymore. That seems to be new. I didn't know that.
Yeah, in fact, the phenomena, so the corn borer BT, the one that kills the caterpillar, still is performing quite well, but the beetle-killing form, the rootworm-killing form, is the one that they're finding problems. And I'll be honest, that is not totally surprising, because the protein that's causing the insecticide activity to kill beetles is not near as strong as the protein to kill the corn borers. And so, you know, you're going with a weaker insecticide, and now they have more than one protein they're playing with, and so the way the companies are trying to fight this is they call it stacking, where they'll put two or three different proteins in to slow it. But definitely, you know, and I guess you take a step back and say anything you come up with, if you push an insect population enough, it will develop a way around it. And so we're not totally surprising that this is happening. The disappointment, I will tell you, is that I know it's controversial to put these genes in, but when you look at the insecticides we had to use to control this problem beforehand, they are far more toxic. They're used in far larger levels. So there are trade-offs going on here. So, but definitely, this has been documented for about 3 years now, Minnesota, Iowa, and Illinois for sure. We haven't seen proof positive in Wisconsin, but would it surprise me? No.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Robin Cherry filling in for Larry Mueller, and our guest today is Phil Pelletieri, entomologist with the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And just a little more on ticks. What ticks are we dealing with in Wisconsin?
Well, what most of us grew up calling wood ticks is the American dog tick. It really doesn't have any disease transmissions that are important to humans here. The deer tick has been the new, relatively speaking, in the last 40, 50 years, and it transmits five different organisms that can harm people. So that's a big concern. And one of the differences with deer tick is that they are active anytime there's no snow on the ground, which is very different, because the regular wood ticks, it was a much more spring and early summer. And then this year in particular, there's a southern tick called the Lone Star tick. And historically, I would see maybe one sample a year or every 2 years. But my colleague Susan Paskowitz has been studying this, and all of a sudden there's an uptick. And I will tell you, between what her students have found and what people have submitted to me, we found 9 ticks this spring of Lone Star ticks, which suggests maybe they're starting to breed up here. Now, the normal range is central Illinois. You know, we've talked on the show so often of other insects that have moved northward because of the lack of cold weather. So some very interesting aspects of this tick, because there is a meat allergy that some people apparently acquire from tick bites of Lone Star ticks. There's a couple other diseases that come into play, and so this will be kind of a stay tuned. I mean, if this pattern continues, then we're going to have to keep that one on the radar screen. So those are the three important for humans. There's another 8 or 9 species you can find on wildlife, but because they don't bite people or don't transmit disease, they really aren't near as important.
Yeah, the Lone Star tick is a rare tick to be found in this area, isn't it?
Well, again, you know, we used to figure that maybe one would hitchhike on a bird and get dropped off, but we're starting to see the numbers now that you're raising your eyebrows and saying, boy, that's an awful lot of bird migration.
Yes.
So, yeah, as I said, I'm not surprised that we haven't found the conclusive proof, but I think as Susan keeps digging, there's no question we'll see that.
All right. Well, let's get back to the phones. We have Mark in Cashton. Good morning.
Good morning. I was out in my garden the other morning, and I heard what I thought was an airplane coming, and it got louder as it got closer. And I looked up, and coming over the hill was a swarm. At the time, I didn't realize, but they came over me about 6-8 feet above my head, and they were bees. But I have no idea what kind they were, and there were thousands, tens of thousands. I've never seen anything like it in my 61 years.
So it had to be honeybees. I mean, at this time of the year, there's no other bee that swarms that way. So we had talked earlier about how when ants swarm, the single queen starts out and she starts everything from scratch. The way bees work is that the queen takes off with sometimes 5,000, 6,000 worker bees. The problem is they don't know where they're moving to. And so it's kind of like the colony splits in half is a way of thinking about it. And beekeepers do things to prevent this from happening because this is kind of like losing your livestock. But so when the swarm goes through, you'll often see them stop on a tree trunk or a fence post and you get this big ball of bees. And they may stay there for a day or two until they can find a hollow tree or other suitable environment to move into, and then they're gone. So when people see swarms, we say the first thing is just let them be. They will run their course on their own. And I'll tell you, they're really non-aggressive when they're in the swarming phase. They're not interested. When bees are most defensive is when the nest is threatened, and technically they don't have a nest anymore. And so, as I said, now it's true that swarms, the longer they stay, they get a little bit edgy. But as I said, as long as you leave them alone, there's not a problem. And it's an interesting phenomena because seeing feral colonies, wild bees, 15 years ago was almost non-existent. And we knew this had a lot to do with varroa mites and other problems that the bees have had. I see more swarms now than I did 10 or 12 years ago, which suggests that in the wild, the bees are making a little bit of a comeback. That being said, this was a terrible winter for bees in Wisconsin. You know, the commercial beekeepers lost somewhere in the neighborhood 30-35%, which is pretty typical of a bad winter. But it's been tough to be a bee person because of varroa mites, viruses, colony collapse. I mean, a whole litany of things that have affected our bee populations.
Let's go to Jean in Milwaukee. She has a question about spider bites. Good morning.
Good morning, Robin. Good morning, Phil. Within the last month, working in the garden, I have been bitten by something twice. And the first time it happened, I had been, again, weeding and picking up grass clippings. Something bit me. By the next day, my forearm had swollen to the size of Popeye post spinach. And when I went to my doctor, she said that spider bites are actually very, very rare. So she prescribed an antibiotic. And that seemed to help. Well, last week I was again weeding in the garden and I saw the little sucker bite me, and it was just one of those little teeny tiny, I call them those little jumping spiders. Mm-hmm. And again, I had a terrible allergic reaction. I'm wondering, are spider bites fairly typical, and is an allergic reaction, am I just lucky that way?
Well, you know, it turns out the research tells us that when people go to the emergency room with a reaction, 95% of what they think is a spider bite is not. And one of the other things, you know, we've talked in the show before about round recluse bites, which is a spider that's extremely rare in this state. And Rick Vetter, who is probably the best spider person I know, he's out in California, but he's published extensively. And it's turned out a lot of what people thought were spider bites are staph infections, because when they ulcerate and the like, they present in a very similar manner. That being said, I know I've had one or two bites in my career. It is unusual. We know that most of what people, you know, wake up in the morning, got its red spot, it's probably not a spider bite. If it was a spider bite, if you look carefully, there should be two punctures, not one. And there are a bunch of insects, you know, assassin bugs and whatnot that will bite too that can cause reactions. To me, because they're injecting enzymes and proteins, you can have a sensitivity to it. And so you can have a reaction. I can't doubt if you saw the spider and felt it. In jumping spiders, even though it's not their nature to bite, they have been documented to bite at times, so that is a bit of a concern. But generally speaking, most of the time when you find a mysterious bite, it probably isn't a spider bite. If it tends to develop a kind of a blister in a day or two, and then goes from there, then I get suspicious. Can't prove it unless I see the two fang marks, but then I get suspicious. Typically, the medical people will give you an antibiotic to prevent secondary infections and sometimes a steroid just to quiet the body down, which is the same way you would handle some of the infections. So as I said, until you have the culprit right on you, it's hard to get final proof. And as I said, for the most part, I would agree with your doctor. They're quite unusual.
Well, then I guess I'll just wear a bee suit the next time I work outside. And
yeah, sometimes that can be useful. Jennifer posted a picture on Facebook of a moth. Mm-hmm. That she would like for you to identify.
So this is in the Sphingidae, the hawk or sphinx moth family. This one is called the blind sphinx, is its common name. And what is just amazing on that picture is you notice it when at rest, the way it folds its wings, I'm impressed she knew it was a moth, because most people are just kind of stunned because
looks like
it looks
a
like, yeah, it's a very strange looking creature. The larvae of these are the hornworms that we have, and we have a number of species in the state. And as I said, this one has been given the name blind sphinx. And I'm not even sure the derivation of that, but, and fly at night, fly like little hummingbirds, and are attracted to lights at night. So sometimes in the morning, you'll see one resting on the side of your house or a door because the security lighting had drawn them in.
Ah, well, let's get back to the phones. Carrie in Dousman has a question about sawdust. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. I am wondering, about a week ago, I noticed some sawdust near a sliding door in my house, and I noticed just a couple of little ants. I always think of them as sugar ants in that area, and I kind of wiped it up, and then we were out of town for a week, and I came home, and there's this huge pile of sawdust in that area. It's like dark, really fine sawdust, and again, there's like maybe one little ant over there, and I've had carpenter ants in a previous home, and I would see carpenter ants in my house, and I've never seen a carpenter ant in my current house. So I'm wondering if it could be these little ants or if it could be something else. Or
well, there are some smaller species of carpenter ants, but not all ants that rest in or nest in rotting wood have to be carpenter ants. But, you know, when people say they find sawdust, the thing that I ask them is, how big is the sawdust, believe it or not? If it's like talcum powder, I go one direction, just like the powder post beetles, but this all sounds like an ant activity. It sounds like, again, there's some soft, compromised wood or substance in that wall, and that's what they're excavating to make their nest bigger. But this is the dead giveaway. This is what I tell people to look for, because it tells me where the nest is located. So now it's just a question, is there any kind of opening or seam along that door frame that you can spray into? What I would suggest is to look for, when you go to the hardware store, a spray can that has a little red applicator straw like you see on a WD-40 can, which will allow you to spray into the wall, because that's what the secret will be. In some cases, if that doesn't exist, you have to drill a very small hole to give you access to spray into the wall. But you know, the ants are showing you where they are, and it should be able to be pretty easy to take care of. The only time this gets tricky is if they're pushing the sawdust out in one spot and the nest is 2 feet away, but that's the only place they can push the sawdust out. But you still know you're in the neighborhood. And so, as I said, I would suggest this is the case where I think you should deal with the ants, only in the sense that even though they're not eating the wood, whether they're taking insulation or structural wood out of there, that's not good. And so, again, it's kind of like seeing smoke. Let's deal with it and being done with it.
A listener earlier mentioned that he had not seen any monarch butterflies. And Kristen on Facebook says, I saw a monarch butterfly in my garden in Whitewater 3 weeks ago, and again about 4 days ago.
Ah, good. Well, as I said, it has not been the weather patterns. I expect to see them early, but in the last couple of weeks, in fact, this week now that they're suggesting these high 80s, which suggests a very strong southerly airflow, that will give us an opportunity to blow more into here, plenty of time to get through at least one generation, maybe two, and so there should be monarchs around by September when they start their migration south.
Yeah, because we look forward to the butterflies, Phil.
Well, I know, and last year was such an interesting year because we had a whole bunch of interesting things blow in early, but it was not a good butterfly year, and we're paying for it this year. I mean, I just have not seen a whole lot of activity, you know, imported cabbage worms and some of those things, but generally speaking, it has been a disappointing year for butterflies, but I think that relates more to last year's weather than it does this.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones. We have Tim in Green Bay. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Say, I have an ant problem, and it's been on and off for a couple years in the front yard, the mounds, and I'm literally a couple blocks from the Brown County Extension Center. They recommended like A7. I tried that, and they kind of came back. And then there's, I'm not sure if you can drop a name, but like Ortho Bug Be Gone, which would be like a granule. I put that on with a spreader, and then they keep coming back. I'm not sure if maybe what it is I'm doing, not doing correctly, and then maybe should I just literally get a shovel and start digging them out?
Sure. So the big mound ants are usually from a genus we call Formica or the field ants. And to be honest, I was just looking yesterday in a book, there's like 130 species of field ants in North America. But here's the problem. The colonies can go for 8 to 10 years. There's a single queen and she's 3 feet down in the ground or 2 feet down in the ground. If you do not kill the queen, you do not solve the problem. And so any of your topical applications, all it does is quiet the ants down because they don't want to cross these treated barriers, but you don't kill the queen. So unfortunately, the secret here is to deal with each nest individually. And what I suggest is to get a metal bar or a crowbar or rebar, or you can even use a wooden dowel, but push it down into the center of the nest. And I want to make three or four channels as deep as I can reasonably get. Then I mix whatever. In the insecticides you mentioned, they all should work. It's just how you're using them. But what I tend to find better than granules is to get a liquid concentrate. Some of these are even common garden insecticides. You mix it to the normal directions. And then I mix it in a bucket. And I pour it down those channels so that I'm getting it as deep in the ground as I can and have a much higher probability of killing the queen. And then you can literally just even rake some soil over the top of it so you don't even have anything exposed. And most of the time, I find that takes care of the colony on one treatment. Once in a while, a real big nest, you do have to go back and try again. But again, it's all about getting deep enough. And I find if you put chemical on the surface and you even turn on the sprinkler and put an inch of rain on, that doesn't work near as well as I said, this kind of focused application that will get it deep enough in the ground to kill the queen.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's go to Barbara in Upper Michigan, who has a question about red biting ants. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. It seems to be the year for the ants, but my ants are red, and they are biting and attacking ants.
Yeah, it's the same genus. It's just a different species. And so, you know, this kind of ant doesn't come in your house, but it is just a nasty ant to have a picnic next to, because if the nest is threatened, they do bite. They don't sting. And so sometimes people mistake that and call them fire ants, which is not something we find here. And depending on the species, it can be a small mound, but some of these make mounds that are 10 inches high and 4 feet wide. I mean, it's just amazing how big they can get over time. So is it in the garden? Is it in your lawn?
It's actually in my rock garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't seem to find where the nest starts. But if I disturb a rock or something, they all come and they start attacking.
See,
and
but
if you step on one or kill one, they actually carry off their dead.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're nesting under the rocks. To be honest, I had to deal with a nest in our own rock garden. I was given instructions by my wife that, and they were just piling up dirt all over. In fact, it's amazing. You went from seeing just a little pile to 4 inches deep in a night, you know. And so I lifted the rock up, did similar to what I had mentioned here, is had the product there, made a couple little channels and poured it down and watched it soak in. And so that has to be the nest. There's no reason you'd have a concentration of ants under a rock unless there's a nest there. And so, as I said, to me, that's the secret. I know where they are. Now I get after the queen. It gets a little frustrating because sometimes there might be 8 or 10 nests located in different spots that have to be treated. But that is the only way I know effectively to get after them.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I'm Robin Sherry, filling in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Robin Sherry, filling in for Larry Mueller, and joining me today is UW-Madison entomologist Phil Pelletieri, and we are talking insects. Let's go to Nancy in Madison. She has an infestation of black ants. Good morning.
Well, I've been waiting for this show because I do have black ants, and we had them last year in the house, and I got these little traps from the hardware store and put them under the dishwasher and stove, and they worked fine. I got them again this year, and we've put the traps in the same places, and they're all over my kitchen. There's some upstairs in the bedroom, and I don't know what to do or why they're not responding.
Okay.
And they're kind of big black ants.
Yeah, they're carpenter ants. And the big question, is this just kind of like the last 3 or 4 weeks you've seen them, or has it been longer this spring?
Just the last 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay, so what we often try to determine, are the ants coming in from outside looking for food, which is meaning that the nest is out in a tree somewhere, or is the pattern such, and I'm getting a little nervous if you keep seeing ants upstairs where there's no food, that they might be nesting indoors.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about ant traps that you have to keep in mind is I've got 15 different species of ants, and they all work differently. And so ants basically have a sweet tooth or feed on protein. Some ants do both. And so you have to make sure you buy the right kind of bait. But I'll be honest with you, the best baits for killing ants are not going to be found at the hardware store. You're going to have to go on the internet, and these are the kind of baits that the commercial people use. They're formulated specifically, but in order to pick the right bait, you have to know what ant you've got. I mean, it's okay. Just, you know, if you got carpenter ants, you have to get this group of baits. If you got pavement ants, there's other groups of baits. And so you have to match the bait to the ant. And so I know I frustrate people when they call me and they say they have an ant problem and they want to use a bait. And I say, boy, you know, I really need to know at the ant before I can send you in the right direction. So, but again, they sound like carpenter ants. They get into dishwashers and the like. And so they have a habit of finding food here, so they just keep coming. Now, the best carpenter ant baits are commercial. There's one called Advanced Carpenter Ant Bait. There's another one called Max Force, both in a carpenter ant bait and a gel. Baits work
Max
best.
Max Force?
Max Force, yes.
Okay.
So if you go to Do Your Own Pest Control, there's three or four sites that have these things. Go under Carpenter Ants, and they will list the various baits. I will tell you that the baits work the best in the spring and the early summer. In the fall of the year, the ants don't have near the food needs and the baits don't work as well. And so if you're going to go that direction, which is the way we try to solve the problem if we don't know where the nest is, I would do it pretty quick because I'm fearful if you wait another 5 or 6 weeks that we're going to be late enough in the season that the ants are going to start to wind down. And sometimes a particular bait works good 1 year, not the next. That's part of the frustration that the ants' food preferences do shift a little bit. But as I said, if you're getting real serious about it, I find that these commercial baits are formulated to do a better job, but they're related to specific species. That's why they were put together.
Okay, so it's doyourownpestcontrol.com.
Well, that's one site, but they said if you just do your own pest control, you'll have 5 or 6 different sites that will pop up very similar that will, you know, you can order on the internet. They'll mail order it, UPS to you, and you'll get it in 3 or 4 days.
You know, they're not huge. They're a little bigger than the sidewalk black ant.
Yeah, carpenter ants differ in the size of their workers. And so, as I said, I mean, technically the things you have to look at are something you cannot, unless you're a trained entomologist, you won't pick it up. But middle to large black or black and red ants in the house are carpenter ants. When we get outside, then I get my field ants because they fit into that category, and they will not come in for food. So it's kind of more where I find them. And again, when I hear about middle-sized black ants and dishwashers, it's always carpenter ants.
All right. Well, we're going to get rid of the ants, and we're going to switch gears and move to garden pests. Amy in West Bend has a question about about slugs in her vegetable garden. Good morning.
Good morning. We have been planting a vegetable garden for a few years here, and last year when we planted our beets, they were gone as soon as the seedlings emerged, and we thought maybe it was a rodent problem. It happened again this year, so we went on the internet to look, and sounds like it might be slugs. And I'm wondering, first of all, does that sound right to you? And second of all, if that is the situation, is there something we can do to get rid of them without harming our other vegetation?
Sure. What I would suggest to confirm it, because earwigs will do that and other things, is to go out at night with a flashlight. And that's when the slugs are active. This is a great weather pattern for slugs. They like it wet. And they feed at night and hide during the day. But I want to see the evidence, because as I said, there's other things that can chew. And if it's earwigs, you'll see the earwigs. So that would be the first point. Slugs are not insects. They're related really to snails. For that reason, they do not respond to insecticides. There are home remedies using beer baits. There is an iron phosphate bait. There are other particular slug baits that use an active ingredient called methaldehyde. These are little pelleted baits that you sprinkle out, and they basically paralyze the slugs. And if a slug gets caught out in the open sun, it's dead. It dries out. And so that's the way they kind of function. Yeah, slug baits you can get at the garden store, and they specifically call themselves slug baits. You know, bug getta, slug getta, sluggo are some of the commercial names you'll see.
Yeah, I saw sluggo on the internet.
Yeah, and so those are all available. I think some people feel more comfortable with the iron phosphate because it's not a more traditional chemical, and I think would be acceptable for organic production, although you might have to check on that. On the other hand, the methaldehyde baits, is that also function in. You hope things dry out a little bit, in a sense, because the drier it is, the less successful the slugs will be. But as I said, I would try the night trick just to confirm, because one would expect slug damage in other kinds of plants. Your hostas is something they often will pick on, rhubarb. Interesting enough, I've seen quite a bit of slug damage on rhubarb in wet years like this. But again, once you see the problem, you can deal with the baits, and it will take care of it.
Okay, so when we go out with a flashlight, you said, is it the earwigs that we would see during the day, or that those
no.
we would see at
they,
night?
No, they see at night, too. But the slugs definitely at night. They you know, are just slimy little half-inch-long creatures. Sometimes they'll leave trails on the leaves, kind of a silvery trail that leave behind. And
well, the whole vegetation that they chose is gone.
Yeah, see, if it happens that quick overnight, I could even say it's cutworms, which is a caterpillar. But, again, they're feeding at night. So it's all about getting out there at the right time to see if we can find the culprit, and then we go from there.
All right. If you're just now joining us, I'm Robin Cherry, filling in for Larry Mueller. And my guest is UW-Madison entomologist Phil Pelletieri. And we are talking bugs and insects today. Let's go to Jim in Pence, who has a question about stink bugs.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I saw a flyer a couple weeks ago, and it said that stink bugs are an invasive species, and when we see one, get rid of it. And I'm just wondering what Phil can tell us about stink bugs, how to get rid of them, what kind of harm they do to our gardens, and any other information he might have.
Okay, so it's not all stink bugs. Stink bug is a family of true bugs. They are shield-shaped, and we've got green ones and brown ones. And
okay, the picture that they showed, it looks similar to a assassin bug, but instead of being long in body, it was kind of oblong shape.
Yeah.
It had the same kind of markings.
Right. The one that they're concerned about is called the brown marmorated stink bug. It's an Asian species that has been wreaking havoc in the Northeast for about the last 6 or 7 years. We're starting to see a trickle. I will tell you, in the last 2 years, I've seen probably about 10 samples of them. Not causing any damage, but one of the things that this brown marmorated stink bug does is it invades houses in the fall like the Asian lady beetle does. So that's one of its unpopular aspects. It feeds on fruits and vegetables. It's a sucking insect, and so you may at first not see a lot of damage, but it causes bruising, blemishing, callousing, discolored spots in the fruit. They might shrivel. I mean, it's... And I hate to say this, but for the people who have battled Japanese beetle and know what that does to your ornamental plants... The marmorated stink bug does that to fruit and vegetables. We're talking tomatoes, peppers. I mean, it is just not a fun critter. And so that's why we're trying to get people to look out for it. There's some reason to be somewhat hopeful that the populations out east started to go in decline last year, and we're hoping that it's coming into some kind of balance, but it's a little early to make that call. So you just kind of watch. And as I said, most of the stink bugs that people send me pictures and whatnot turn out not to be the marmorated stink bug. They seem to be native species that cause minor damage and aren't much of a concern. When the marmorated stink bugs come on, they're going to be everywhere. And so it's going to be quite obvious, I think, if it does take off. It has been intercepted in all the Midwestern states to some degree. In Wisconsin, the counties that we have records for are Brown, Jefferson, and Dane.
Okay, thanks.
All right. We have a picture that's been posted on Facebook of a possible assassin bug that bit Roger's wife.
Mm-hmm. Now, assassin bugs are predators. And this is a baby assassin bug. It's a nymph. I can tell it's not an adult. And this would be one of the things that could get you outside. I'll tell you, though, that most of the time an assassin bug, you feel the pain. It feels like a bee sting. And because they have enzymes that they use to digest and paralyze their prey out of body, if they get those in locally, your tissue is not going to be happy. So it's a painful experience, might be a lot of swelling, might be some numbness. And so I agree. It doesn't bite you on purpose, but being a predator, it bites it to defend itself. And as I said, it's an experience that will get your attention. In the adults, some of the assassin bugs are an inch and a quarter long. And as I said, it can cause a reaction that might take a few days to kind of settle down. And that's what I often wonder when people have a serious reaction when they go in the emergency room. It might be more likely assassin bug. But I go back to that point. You feel it. It's not where sometimes spider bites are subtle. And
right.
And they kind of evolve over a few hours.
What a name for a tiny bug.
Well, yeah, but assassin is what they do. They sit in the shrubbery and wait for other insects to come by and latch on and kill them.
Wow. Well, I'm Robin Cherry. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller today. If you're just now joining us, Phil Pelletieri is my guest. And we are talking about bugs and insects. And if you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. So what are we in for in general for the summer season regarding bugs and insects?
Well, compared to last year, I mean, last year I set a record for a number of samples, and, you know, it was an extended growing season. We had a bunch of southern migrants. This feels like a normal year to me. I mean, I'm really not seeing, in fact, of anything, I'll tell you, it has been somewhat quiet compared to what I would consider a normal summer. If the heat really kicks in, it might make some changes to that. But overall, as I said, a lot of things because of the drought last year has kind of changed the dynamic. And I'm not looking for anything over the top this year. So,
well, what's a normal year?
Well, you know, I've got 25,000 species of insects, so I always have somebody that likes the weather. So we kind of wait and see.
All right. I'm Robin Sherry filling in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Insects can be fascinating to watch, like a bumblebee flitting from flower to flower or a firefly lighting up the night sky. That's the fun part. Dodging mosquitoes, not so much fun. I'm Robin Sherry filling in for Larry Mueller. Entomologist Phil Pelletieri is our guide to the world of insects today. Phil, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Or I should say, welcome back to the show. It's always nice having you. Let's go to Facebook. Mary put a picture up and she's from south of San Francisco, and we don't know what this is, so you're going to have to tell us.
Okay, so it kind of looks like a bumblebee, kind of looks like a hummingbird, and it turns out it is in that same hawk moth or sphinx moth family that we had talked about before, but this is a different species. The genus is Himeris, and they are day-flying bumblebee mimics. This probably is Himeris thisbe, which is the snowberry clearwing, but I can't see enough of it. There's about three species, and this being a California species, there might be a western one I'm not aware of, but it's not unusual for this family, especially the day flyers, to be mistaken for hummingbirds, but they're quite a bit smaller. At least this one is. There are some species that are the same size as hummingbirds, and neat creature. If it is thisbe, the caterpillars are found on honeysuckle. And the adults will be nectaring at any flowers that they can find.
Well, let's go to Mike in Milwaukee. Good afternoon. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Yes.
You're on the air.
Yes. All right, Phil. Let's see. I was just curious about this phenomenon that I used to observe over the years with the June bugs, or also known as May beetles, where they congregate on sidewalks, and they have like a bunch of little drunks stumble and tip over.
Yeah, well, they're very clumsy creatures, and you know, it turns out that there's like 140 species in that genus Phalophaga. They're scarab beetles, and I will tell you, even though I get calls, there are some places this year in the state there were quite a few June beetles out. But in my area of Madison that I grew up with, there is not near the populations they were that I remember as a kid. They have a 2 to 3 year life cycle depending on the species. And again, lots of different species involved. But they're interesting creatures. They're attracted to light at night. And then during the day, to be honest, they really kind of lay low. And I think a lot of times that's what you might be seeing, that there's a big street light that might have drawn a bunch in. And then the next morning you see them just kind of hanging on the sidewalk and whatnot. And they walk clumsy. You even wouldn't understand they can fly. They're not quick flyers, but once they get moving, they can go around. And the buzz reminds you a little bit of a bumblebee, at least it does to me. And oftentimes they start flying right at dusk. In those years that you see a lot of them, you can hear a lot of buzzing. And then, of course, you hear a lot of them bumping into your screens at night because they're attracted to the lights around in the house.
Well, I think the last time that I observed it was downtown Milwaukee about maybe 15 years ago or so.
Yeah, well, you do see certain years that are higher populations in different parts. I had some people in Marionette County talk about how it was a pretty good year for June beetles up there. Why that's important is if we're going to have grub damage in the lawns, it's usually the year after the high adult populations. And But as I said, it is interesting to find that at least in cities, and it probably has a lot to do with just the change in environment there, because they're pretty much a grass species, so you get pastures and whatnot. That's where you expect to find lots of diversity in the June beetles.
All right. Thanks for your call, Mike. We have Paul in Richland Center. Good afternoon.
Afternoon. Phil, I've heard you talk in the past about Japanese beetles moving in cycles. For the past 2 to 3 years, I've had just an onslaught of Japanese beetles in my yard, last year, of course, being the worst. This year, I haven't seen any. So I'm wondering, am I being too optimistic and they're not out yet?
Yes.
Because we're having somewhat of a more normal spring, or...
Yeah, so the dynamic is the 1st of July is kind of the typical, maybe a couple of days earlier. And last year they were a couple weeks early, but everything was early. And you must, what part of the state are you located in?
Richland Center, okay. Southwest part.
So the dynamic is the cycle to me is about a 10 to 14 year experience,
okay.
In that they build and build for probably 5 to 6 years, in an area. And then over time they seem to settle down. So, you know, on the west side of Madison now, I see about 10% of the population I saw 8 or 9 years ago. And then throw on top of it, the drought is probably going to slow them up. My prediction for many parts of the state is the numbers are down, but what you're telling me you've been seeing in Richland Center, they're just on the buildup side. So they're coming. And as I said, I would say the last few days of June, 1st of July is when you start to see them, and then it's going to be 2 months of misery.
Does it make any sense to start spraying around the places where they were last year with 7?
No. You basically, because the 7 only lasts for 3 or 4 days, you wait till they get there. And you may be blessed. I mean, you find sometimes, you know, they used to pick on some potentilla bushes we had in the front of the house, and, you know, that was kind of an annual thing. But 1 year, they decided to pick on my neighbor's Cotone ester, and they never showed up, you know. And so, as I said, you kind of react to when they come, and maybe I'll be wrong. But as I said, if you're in that early stage of infestation, only 3 or 4 years in, I do expect probably similar numbers, or maybe a little down because of the drought. Some of it depends on your location. You know, I live a block and a half from a golf course, and my colleague Chris Williamson in his research can find 60 to 80 per square foot in golf courses. And then they migrate out of those golf courses. So it doesn't matter if it's dry or not. The golf course always has water. So those are often the source of a lot of people's headaches. But even again, in my neighborhood, things are getting into a little bit more of a balance. Still wish there was less than there are. But, you know, a 90% reduction to me is a big improvement.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I'll get ready.
Thank you. Phil, you mentioned the drought. What is going to be the most glaring indication of our insect environment because of the drought we had last year?
Well, the thing that I was extremely nervous about is the stress that the drought put on our trees opens up the door for a bunch of wood borers that attack stress trees. And I thought, boy, this is going to cause us oak trees and hickory trees and, you know, pine trees, all kinds of things. And I've changed my tune because this excess moisture that we've had this spring, honestly, will get the trees strong enough that they will fight the bugs off themselves. And so I have been very pleasantly surprised because I just wasn't expecting. As I said, it was such a significant drought that put so much stress on our plants. And as I said, usually after that, for the next 3 to 4 years, I will find wood borers killing our plants, and I'll point back to the drought. But as I've seen enough of a change. It's such a good growing season. In a lot of cases, it's like you turn a light off, you know, and I do expect that as a positive thing. And the other headache of last year, all the spider mite problems we get, spider mites don't like it wet. So I'm not expecting any spider mites this year. And as I said, that one is a little easier to predict because it's so related to that, what I call California weather. You get spider mites, you get Wisconsin weather, you don't.
Right. All right. Well, that is good news. Let's go to Barb in Gotham. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm just curious to know about some caterpillars I've seen this year in my yard. I had the hopper crab bloom beautifully, and my neighbor was over here, and she noticed it had a spider type web going, and we took it down, and there were caterpillars in there. And burned them, but now the peonies were blooming. It's across the yard and far enough away, you would think, but there were black striped caterpillars when I was picking the peonies in there. And I just wondered if that's the same type of caterpillar, or is it going to come back? Because I've got big trees here, too, that are in danger.
My first guess is not, because I'll go back to I'm very confident that the critter you had in the crabapple was an eastern tent caterpillar. If you look at them carefully, they have kind of a golden hair to them, and although they have a black base to the body, there are both white and a very attractive bluish markings on it. And you know, there's just so many caterpillars that are black. So I would have to know the specific markings. Do they have spines? Do they have orange spots? I mean, that all plays in there. There really isn't much that messes with peonies. So I'm a little, I don't know if the caterpillars are just kind of moving through or the like. You can always either take a picture of it, and email me the picture, or send a specimen in. But as I said, I really am not worried. In fact, that's the other interesting dynamic with all this moisture this year. Things like gypsy moth that right now should just be finishing up and causing all kinds of damage on oak trees. I expect most of them got sick and died. You know, that this kind of weather does promote a lot of fungal diseases and insect populations. And although that may cost us a few butterflies, it also takes care of some of these pests.
Yeah.
Okay, I got one more thing to ask you. This is a spider that I have never seen. It's very, very tiny. And it has a red abdomen, bright red. It's just shocking to look at it. I've never seen something like this. And they are hatching out like crazy. They came out when they were removing some windows from my living room wall and replacing the with new windows. And now they're all over the ground underneath there. And I see them coming over to my wood ramp, which is about 7 or 8 feet away. And now they're in the ramp boards. I see them when I'm walking up and down. So I don't know what kind of damage they're doing or if they are damaging anything. But
so the first question
in the back is stains when you squish them. It's just a really bright red stain.
Okay, it's not a spider. They're called velvet mites. And I have been getting a lot of samples and calls about this. Velvet mites are really very fast. So they're kind of as quick as a spider. But you never find herds of spiders, you know, these just all over the place. And as you say, one of the characteristics, if you crush them, they will leave a stain. And that's really the only thing I'm concerned about, because if they're in your house and you start wiping them up and aren't careful, you will, you know, stain the walls and the like. They're predators, interesting enough. They feed on insect eggs and other things. And I am at really quite a loss to explain why they're having a good year, because I don't know what they're feeding on. And I find them. One of my friends brought a sample in from the 7th floor of a university building where they were just crawling all over, getting on people's desks. I knew the source was outside. In fact, we found the source was on the top of the gravel roof. So I know where they come from, but what I am absolutely confused about is what the devil are they eating up there? But for whatever reason, these velvet mites are having a good year. And if they're problematic, you can kill them with soapy water. The soap is only a contact kill, so if they keep coming, you might have to spray again. I don't suggest spraying indoors for them. If they're problematic, you spray along the outside foundation and kill them where the source is. But how long they'll be around, I'm not sure. It would surprise me if it's more than a couple weeks. But again, from your description, and in particular because I've seen so many samples, I don't remember a year in my career of seeing this many velvet mite samples. And as I said, what confuses me is I know what the way they're supposed to behave, but I don't know what they're eating.
All right. If you're just now joining us, I'm Robin Cherry filling in for Larry Mueller. And my guest is UW-Madison Extension entomologist Phil Pelletieri. And we are talking bugs and insects today. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Now, we have an email. Don called. Obviously, he couldn't hang on. Don called and was wondering about silverfish. Should he be concerned about them being in the house?
Only if you collect rare books. I mean, silverfish feed on starch-based things. They've caused a little problem on wallpaper and the like. And it's not that uncommon for older houses to have a couple of them. Now, if he told me he found 20 a day, that would raise my eyebrows and say, you know, you got to deal with it because they might be chewing on paper. But for the most part, they're slow to breed, controlled by spiders and other things, so they don't kind of overrun things. One of the things that one can do to the environment, as much as you can dry things out, they tend to like things on the damper side. And they do respond to ant sprays. If you really have to, you can put things out. One of the other things that they used to use against them is being starch feeders. I've seen little sachets made up basically of cornstarch with boric acid. And if they feed on that, the boric acid is the stomach poison. So really the cornstarch is to get them to feed on it, and so they ingest it. And that would be kind of a home remedy to treat for them. But, yeah, normally I don't get too nervous about them.
Now, what do silverfish look like? I'm thinking of a traditional fish.
Okay, so they get the name because if you look at them under the microscope, they have little scales on their body. And so that's where the name is derived. They have a pair of long antennae out the front, and then they have three antenna-like structures out the back. And they're kind of torpedoed shaped. They're kind of round in the front, a little sharper on the back. Spend most of their time hiding underneath things, scurrying around at night. There's sometimes a misconception that they come out of your drains. Well, what happens is if they fall in the sink, they can't climb out of the porcelain. And so they're trapped in there. And so more active at night. They can feed on the cellulose and paper in the walls. And so, as I said, older houses can have a few of them. But the only thing that would concern me is if we had a bunch of them. And as I said, the rare book thing, because they can feed on book bindings and starch paper. That's why you've got to be a little careful in those situations.
So but, hoarders would have these things?
Yes. Well, hoarders, you know, there's just so many niches. There's lots of things that
well, if could, they hoard, if you hoard newspapers and magazines. And
yes, definitely.
Okay. All right, that's what we want to know. Let's go to Matt in Ashland. Good afternoon.
Hi, Robin. Hi, Phil. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I bought a house a year ago, and this summer have been noting just one or two dead bumblebees every now and then on the basement floor. And I wasn't sure if that's anything to be concerned about or what it might signify.
So the way bumblebees work is that the inseminated queens in the fall go crawl under a rock or find some hiding place. And then in the spring of the year, they need to find a hole of some sort, an old gopher burrow, sometimes an old bird nest or birdhouse. Or sometimes if there's a void space in a wall, they will get in there. And then they raise their brood. So a bumblebee colony can have 60, 70 workers in it by the end of the summer. To find a number of queens in a house at one time is a little strange. When I hear a story like yours, what I suspect is that there is a nest either in a wall or along the outside foundation, and something has happened so that the bumblebees aren't finding their normal way out, and they get confused, mm-hmm. and then they come to wherever there's light, and so they kind of spill in the basement. So what I would suggest is just sometime on a nice sunny day, walk slowly around the outside of the house to see if you can find out where the activity is coming from. Because the numbers are relatively small, the only time I see people make mistakes with bumblebees is if they're disappearing into a wall and they decide to plug the hole, then the bees that are in there are going to be quite agitated and they're going to find a way out. And so, as I said, whether they come down through the sill plate or a light fixture, they find their way in. So all it does suggest to me is that there's probably a nest either in the walls or along the foundation. And as I said, something's going on that's preventing the bees the normal access, and that's what's forcing them. And the numbers get bigger over time. You know, they start with a single queen, and so finding four or five bumblebees already at this time to me is suspicious, definitely, that there's a nest. But as I said, if you can find the opening and let them get their normal access going, coming and going, they don't come back to the nest next year, so that's not a problem. It really, the only time bumblebees are much of an issue is if you disturb the nest, because then they're defensive.
Okay, so nothing that I need to buy or spray or anything like that. Just kind of figure out where they're at.
Right.
Perfect. Thanks, Bill.
All right. Thanks for your call, Matt. Joanne in Black River Falls. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for taking my call. My question is about springtails, and they're small. I don't know that they actually fly, but they certainly know how to hop.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found them in my stationary tub in the basement. And I don't know how it is that they're there.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried different things, like even just keeping it totally dry. I've used the stopper. I've used soapy water. I've tried ammonia, and other times bleach down the drain, thinking they're coming out of there. But they're there. I just cannot eliminate them.
So silverfish is a whole group of insects. They do not fly. They're wingless. Their claim to fame is many of the species have a little device that allows them to jump. It's like a little fork that they push off from. They are the most common creature in rich organic matter soil. And in order to exist, they need two things. They need moisture and they need organic matter. So I'm really don't think it's your drain. I think they're spilling in from somewhere that is too moist. And so, you know, sometimes I'll get people who have springtail problems in their shower. And what it is that the grout has started to go, the water's getting behind, and they literally are breeding behind the tiling. Other times, and I've had a number of these, and it's a much more frustrating problem, is people have them by the gazillions outside. I mean, we're talking 2 inches deep type of silverfish. And then they spill into the house and cause a nuisance. And what gets frustrating there is that they're small enough bodied, they could be blowing in from 100 yards away. And, you know, it's very hard to do something about that to stop that. But usually in a couple, 3 weeks, they run their course. So in your situation where this has been reoccurring, there's no evidence that the source is outside, you've got a leak somewhere that is keeping the moisture levels up. And that's where the silverfish are coming from. The springtails are coming from. So anything you can do to dry the basement will help. But I'd poke around a little bit because, again, if you can identify the leak source and get it stopped leaking, no moisture, no silverfish or springtails. I don't know where I'm going to silverfish. Silverfish on the mind. But
I did have a hanging basket over winter right above that stationary tub.
And was it a plant that you kept watered or not?
I did for the majority of the, you know, off time.
That could easily
but,
be.
Not entirely.
They're very common, and I do see them in houseplant soil, especially if you've taken some soil from the garden because they're feeding on the organic matter there. So they're happy as heck. I mean, that's their normal environment is to live in soil. And that might explain everything that's going on.
Do you feel then that they will just expire in time, or is it something I need to do about keeping moisture?
So if the source was the potted plant, you removed it, things should be majorly improved within 2 weeks. If that didn't solve it, there's another source. And that's where it takes a little bit of detective work. But as I said, I tell people it's not something you normally spray for. It's something you adjust the environment for to take care of the problem.
All right. Well, we only have a few minutes left. And this time went by very, very quickly.
Yeah,
you made insects and bugs fun.
Well, you know, I tell you, as a biologist, it's not hard, I don't think, because they're such a diverse group and they're always doing interesting things. And unfortunately, we're always getting new ones. You know, now that I'm at that point in my career, I sit back and in the last 35 years, I can probably name 150 things that are here now that weren't here before. And sometimes these things are not problematic, but unfortunately, most of the time they are. And on the other hand, if you take a step back, just as organisms, they're just intriguing. They do all kinds of interesting things, and many of them are really quite beautiful to look at if you take the time.
And it seems like a never-ending war, us against them.
Well, if you don't realize that they have won the war already, you're not looking at it.
That's for sure. I am Robin Sherry. I filled in for Larry Mueller today. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.